the day I turned 30, I sold everything I had and I went downtown and I booked a ticket to San Francisco.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Wayne McSweeney. Wayne is a psychologist but also a singer-songwriter that released an album under the name Street Corner Messiahs. The conversation moves from therapy to music to domestic abuse and anything in between. Unfortunately, the connection wasn't fantastic, so some of the audio is not perfect, but I hope you enjoy the conversation. This is the last podcast of 2020. I really appreciate you listening, and as always, if you can leave a review, download, share it, help us to carry on making some good podcasts. The music is shortened for rights reason. You can find the full playlist on Spotify. The show is also broadcast weekly on Near FM every Monday and on Flirt FM every Tuesday. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
So listen, first of all, thanks a million for joining me. I think there's a few things have happened since I started this podcast a few years ago, and then during lockdown I was asked to do during the first lockdown, I should say, I was asked to do an extra program by Near FM, and I started that in the neighborhood, and that turned out to be really interesting because I'm getting to know people like yourself and I'm getting to know new music, and so anyway, that's where it all came about, and then I just want to know more. I always love music. I love art in general. And I was talking to Vivian Long a couple of days ago for this podcast. And Anya is coming on next week to talk about the new song, fabulous new song. So it's literally, that's all I do. I'm trying to do as much as I can with my little platform for the community at large. Yeah. And music is a big part of that. But then when I was reading about you, I thought, there's a bit more than music there with this man. I'd like to know a bit more about it. And that's really where it came about. So thanks for joining me. Where are you? Middleton, is it?
Oh, yeah, thanks. Thanks so much. Sorry? Oh, yeah, Middleton in Cork.
Lovely, yeah. Lovely place.
We're the center of the universe for Middleton people.
Very good.
And I guess our thing is, if people want to know where Middleton is, especially if they're around the world, all you have to do is mention Jameson whiskey, and I think everybody in the world is familiar with that, and we say we're from there. So
excellent. So listen, let's talk about you first before we get to your album. Tell me a bit more about you. I did a bit of research, I read a little bit, but I love your path, and it's been a lot of helping people, really. That's what you do, right?
Yeah. That's what I do. Yeah, I'm a psychologist, but I don't sit in an office. I work mainly with kids, I think, because growing up in Ireland in the 70s, I grew up in a one-parent family. It was just my mom, me and my three brothers. And it was a different time because even the working class then did support each other quite a bit. You know, if your neighbor had something, they'd give you part of it. And I just grew up with that. And it's where, I guess, for me, it was most comfortable sitting with people or supporting people through a dysfunction that they may have or a hardship. It's just what I do, what I'm comfortable doing, what I understand. And so, you know, I took it to the level where I began working with people with disabilities. And then it moved on to kids who were in trouble, kids with addiction. And then in the States, I worked with the homeless. So there was, as you can imagine, and one of my jobs is working in a transitional housing project and getting men and women out of jail. And so there it was. And in California, it's funny because the penal system there, and especially for the homeless, if you're arrested for a misdemeanor or something, they can keep you locked up for 6 months, right. You know, and for some people it became a way of life. It was terrible. And so I was lucky to have met this fantastic woman, Pam, who offered me a job. And from there, you know, I started going in and out of prisons, going in and out of homeless shelters, meeting homeless people. And they reminded me of friends I had, and we became friends, many of us. People who struggled with addiction, people who struggled with mental health issues, people who struggled with, like, the whole gamut of stuff. And I suppose they offered me an insight to it. And there was never fear or anything because, you know, even some of their backstories were, I'll give you an instance, one guy who he was on his close to his third strike, which means he would be locked up forever. And he told me his life story, and it was horrendous. And he tried to explain to me how he survived. Like he'd been a gang member. He'd been witness to, you know, a number of murders. He himself had a breakdown in prison and started a riot. But he finally got to a point where he wanted the war to stop. He explained to me what he meant by war. And we eventually got him to a place where he lived in supported living. But there was lots of people like that whom we would be afraid of, or we would, you know, we would use stories like that to frighten our kids. If you don't stop, then you'll end up blah, or you'll end up there, you know. But a lot of the people, they were kind of, most of them, it was like non-violent drug offenses. But they were locked up forever, and they were treated like they were terrible. And so I found a place where I guess I sat comfortably, and I know I've said that before, and I had the ability, I guess, through these people, what they've taught me is to bring that to other people. So now at the moment, I work with young kids and teenagers who, many of who might be ASD, autistic spectrum disorder, who may have run in contact with police, young kids, you know, as young as 6, who I absolutely adore. They're maniacs. They remind me of me and my friends when we were kids. But they're awesome, but there's a great learning. Sorry.
No, just but that's the perfect point. So it's a bit of a delay, but I was going to ask you, because that's the perfect point when you just say it reminds you of you and your friends when you were kids. I just want to go back to that for a second because, you know, from Middleton, that's where you grew up and as a kid. And just expand a little bit on that, what you were saying, you're learning, you're, you know, from a single family, from a single mother, and just give me a bit more of a sense of that, because that's obviously what formed the studies came after, the ideas came, but just give me a bit more of that, please.
It was the 70s in Ireland, and we were ruled with an iron fist by the church. It all changed for me when I met... Well, there was a number of people, a couple of teachers that I had who recognized that I wasn't bad because I came from a one-parent family. I wasn't doomed to burn in hell. That there was a good in, you know, every kid you find it. But there were two people in particular. One was a Christian brother who actually only died this year, an incredible man. And he helped me to understand humanity, I guess, in a way that hadn't been shown to me. And the second one was, after my dad left, a priest came to our house. This was in the 70s. He knocked on the door and he said, "Hi, is your mom there?" And I says, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." So she came to the door and said, "Hello, Father, how are you?" And I won't mention his name. I'm good. And he said to her, "I heard your husband left." And she said, "Yeah, yeah. If I go and bring him back, will you have him?" No. And my mother just looked at him and she said, I'm not going to swear now, but I'll bleep this. She said, "Father, you can go and F yourself." And the door in his face. And we, up to that point, I had believed that I was going to hell, that our family were terrible, that there was no hope for me. But, and slowly talking to different people, we began to see that we were young men and young women. We were working class. I saw the humanity, a working class area where all of us looked out for each other. But none of us, you know, we went with in a fashion at that time that, that seemed to suit that time. You know, you could be spotted away from home and Mrs. Smith would go, ah, does your mother know you're here? And you were terrified and you went home. Or the policeman would give you a boot in the arse instead of taking it to court. I guess in any work area that you go to, nowhere in the world, you will find people there who have come to the system, who have seen work and the strategies and things that you need to use to support the people in those areas and in those situations to move out of poverty, out of ignorance, out of into education, into a belief. And I guess that's where all this came from, is that we were poor, we lived in a working class area, we were happy, we were loved. And there is no greater feeling than that, I think. And that's what I try and bring to my work with kids and with adults and with their families, is that you are worthy. I want to work with you until we get to a point where you can do this on your own. So, but it's not saving them. It's walking this journey with them. And I feel very privileged because, you know, if I'm working with a six-year-old, I get to be 6 years old, which is awesome. If I work with a parent, I get to be somebody who they would look at to say, okay, this person has XY experience. They like what they do. And they seem to be okay. So I get to be an adult as well. So I get to flicker between all of these different things. But to be in situations that I feel are privileged because somebody may open their heart to you and you can be the first person that they've done that to. But that then is the start of a recovery or a journey into recovery. Now, it might take 50 years, but it's a start. And I feel that I may have facilitated that, and that's an awesome feeling. It is, you know.
Brilliant. Let me break it with the first song you picked, which is one of my favorite artists, Tom Waits, Martha. How'd you pick that song?
Yeah. I've been a huge Tom Waits fan. And when I lived in California, I used to live near him.
Oh, wow.
And when I got to California first, I worked in a vacuum store. So I used to fix vacuum cleaners. And I found out where Tom lived, and I knew people who knew him. And every single person that would come into the store, I would say to them, if you see Tom, send him in. And I did that for 2 years. So he sent his son in to me to ask me to stop trying to contact him. And then if he wanted a vacuum, he would come and talk to me. That's my Tom Waits story. But it came out of that. It was the idea that somebody in their early 20s could look that far forward, knowing that they'd missed out on something and trying to reconnect with somebody, you know. And I suppose I heard that song 30-odd years ago. And as an adult now, I kind of wonder back, why would you go backwards? And that's just me. But there are people, you know, and there is something within all of us, and I think he captures it best with that song. I met a woman about 20-odd years ago in the Czech Republic who had been a jazz musician, and herself and her husband had been jazz musicians during the Second World War, and they were made to play for the Nazis and things. But at the end of the war, she met, they were liberated. She wasn't married, she was young. And she met an American GI. But as she was telling us this, she got up, she walked off, went to a drawer, pulled out an envelope and came back. And as her husband had been dead for years. But as though somebody were watching her, she took out the picture, looked around her and showed us this picture. And it was from, I think it was 1945. And it was a GI who had offered her all these fantastic things. Come to America, you know. It's the land of chocolate and nylons. Why would you want to be here in the Czech Republic? And so she kept that forever, even though she'd been happily married for years and years and years. And I suppose we're human. You know, we may have fallen in love with the person who got away. And then you'd wonder, if they hadn't got away, what would happen? You know, and so there's been a few things throughout my life, but I love the idea of this sepia-toned picture of a GI, you know, and I think this was in 2000 and, oh God. Oh, it was 1999, actually, sorry. But it was 45 years after the war, but she still carried this with her. And that, I guess, every single person who looks back, even when they were 16, to say Mary was the one, or Maria was the one, or somebody, but she got away. And I think if you don't have that, your life will be just that little bit emptier. You have to have a small piece in your heart somewhere with a drawer that you can pull out and time travel back to a time when things were innocent and beautiful and perfect. Because in the world that we have, there aren't too many of those, but I think Waits does that for me. He allows me to go back to a time, that time.
Operator, number please. It's been so many years. She remembered my old voice while I fight the tears. Hello, hello, there is this Martha, this is old Tom Frost. And I am calling long distance, don't worry about the cost.
Wonderful, great story.
Yeah.
So, speaking of that, speaking of going back in time, I'm trying to picture Wayne, early 20s, leaving Middleton, as you say, the center of the world for you guys from Middleton. But next thing, you're in California, which is, you know, it's a huge place. It's the land of opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. But you worked in the vacuum store for a while. But what was that transition from there to starting to work with people in, from they come out of jail and, getting involved with all that? Give me a bit of sense of that, please.
Well, Middleton, then this was the 90s, and Tommy Tiernan has a great joke where one Irish person went somewhere and the rest of us said we're following with our sleeping bags. It happened in Middleton. Somebody went, a few more people went, and then I went. My dream was, the day I turned 30, I sold everything I had and I went downtown and I booked a ticket to San Francisco. My plan was to hitchhike and play music from San Francisco, Greenwich Village, and then come home on the road. I thought there's a book or there's a million songs in this and I'll meet those characters or I'll be killed on the way or I'll get home and I'll have great stories. So I ended up in San Francisco. I ended up in the Tenderloin. I ended up in a dive bar. And I ended up getting gigs. And so I stayed. And I suppose living in any big kind of working class or underclass urban area in a dive bar, which I didn't know it was, but I got to know some of the people there. And they were the characters from books that I'd read. They were the characters from movies I'd seen. And these were the people whose stories I wanted to know and I wanted to be around, even just, to try and be invisible to see what their lives were like. And you can imagine, I got out of the airport in San Francisco and it was four lanes of traffic going one way, four coming back the other way. We just had one lane going either way. And everything was bigger and faster and they spoke weird. And there was buildings that, you'd nearly crack your neck looking at. And I was going, oh my God, what's this? Anyway, I never got out of San Francisco because there was too much to see and do. Like in my first week there, I met Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. I met Ron Kovac, Ozzie Davis. I met a couple of weeks later. But these were the people that were there. There was lots of protests. And so to me, I guess, loving the 60s and loving some of the music from the 60s. Here it was happening in the 90s. And I was part of it and I was getting as much of that as I could. So it was like, this is where you need to be. Let's see what happens. Yeah. And it sort of blew my mind.
Very good. And that's where you, is that where you started to get all your stories from, the tales of, from the Tenderloin, which we'll get to in a minute.
That's where they all came from, and it all began, because it was a hodgepodge of artists, musicians, homeless people, working girls, working boys, people who were trans, everything. You know, on your way to work, you would be propositioned for drugs or sex at least 20 times. Mm. And eventually, you got to know the people in your neighborhood, which is, I would sing to myself, it was like, the shopkeeper, the prostitute, the drug dealer, the Irish man going to work. and I became part of their neighborhood. And so after me saying no and them seeing me a couple of times, I was just somebody who moved through their space. And I guess I learned to respect the space, or to be invisible in that space, because it's theirs. And it's all very tribal, which is interesting. It's the first time I'd ever been in a big city like that. But from block to block, things would be completely different. So yeah, that's kind of where I was, and it felt like home, and I felt safe there because I didn't go out after 12 o'clock at night. And you know, you knew who to avoid, and yeah, it was a really interesting time.
Brilliant. So tell me about this, the next one that you have, which is Lou Reed, which probably Caroline says, tell me about that one.
I am. And again, with Reed, because like there's lots of people who would sing about kind of dysfunction and you know, broken hearts and people, but nobody does it like Lou Reed. It's like when I heard Berlin first, because I had bought Transformer expecting everything to be like Walk on the Wild Side, which it wasn't. And then I went and bought Transformer, and I nearly lost my mind because I'd never heard anything like it. It was as though this was a window into this dysfunctional relationship between Jim and Caroline and all the horrible things that went on. And I'd never heard anything like that. And I suppose working with people who were living that, this was the truest thing that I'd have anybody sing about, because first of all, I kind of questioned, should you sing about these things? Well, we should know about them. Should everybody have access to it? I think so. But the one thing that killed me, and I wish he was still around, because at the start of that, he kind of says, Caroline says, as she picks herself up off the floor, "Why do you beat me? This isn't any fun." And for some reason, I always feel myself going, "Anymore." I would love to ask him if that's what he meant. I spent a lot of time researching domestic violence for a PhD as well. So that would kind of tie into that, because you go to a place and you interview people and they bring you to a place that's often very raw, and you try to understand how they speak about the imaginable things that they've gone through at the hands of somebody who said they love them. And so I think for me, Caroline Says, like part two, is if you want to know, or you want to really understand what domestic violence is, that you listen to that, or anybody's kind of at the end of their rope. That kind of is the thing for me, is that that's where it is. That's the edge. But there's kind of, you know, within there as well, I think it's kind of, she's not afraid to die. So she's gotten to a certain point. I know it's a bit morbid, but having done it for so long and being in a place that I support people to that, it's the reality of what a lot of people face. And I think we shouldn't shy away from those things, and that these people need to be understood. A lot of the time there's victim blaming. Oh, why does she stay? Why does he stay? You know, instead of saying, what are the obstacles to transitioning away from this? So it kind of gives an understanding, I think, to it. Now, not everybody will want to examine it the way I have. Absolutely adore that song and that album.
Caroline says, as she gets up off the floor, "Why is it that you beat me? Isn't any fun." Caroline says,
let me stay with that. I was going to come back to this, but now that you mentioned the PhD, I was just reading your PhD is on men's experience of intimate partner violence, right? On this podcast, I interviewed Sharon O'Halloran. You know, she's chairwoman of Safe Ireland, and so we discussed that at length. And it was during the first lockdown, so there was an increase in violence and so on. But you specifically went into the experience. Tell me a bit what you found and a little bit more about it, because I'm really interested, and I know very little about it.
Yeah, so what I want, like, first of all, we know it's a huge issue for women and children. We know it's a huge issue. In this, and it's also an issue for men. Not all men. In the 70s, Aaron Prizzi opened the first shelter in the world for women. It was a council flat. She packed as many women in there as she could, but she found that a lot of the women that she supported were as violent. And now violence is on a spectrum, so it goes from, you know, aggression to death. So you have this continuum. But a lot of these women were as violent, or if not more violent, than the men that she that they were transitioning away from. So what I found was, I, and again in the States, there was quite a few men whom I supported out of prison who began to tell me their stories as well. And I was like everybody else, what? You know, you're 6 foot two. Your wife was 5 foot two. How did she beat you? And so they explained it to me. They had been raised in a particular way. Strike a woman, you know, the stoic kind of John Wayne thing. And so more and more, I saw quite a bit of it and went looking for support for the men. And there was none. They were homeless. I was told, oh, you know, if you can get $250, you can start a group and pay me $250 every week and I'll talk to these men. These men had nothing. So throughout their stories, all their stories had a common, it was linear. It's told in a very specific way, all of them. And it's not like they knew each other, and they told their stories again in a very specific way through metaphor. So I was intrigued by this because firstly, all there was no support. Secondly, they explained to me and I went, okay, this is true, because you begin to see the patterns in these things. There was some support there for women. There isn't enough. There needs to be more, but there was no support there for men. So when I came home, I went to UCC, did the degree, and then put out a questionnaire, tried to develop a questionnaire, and it was experienced and expressed violence. So I experienced, but it was the whole gamut, emotional, psychological, physical, sexual, financial, judicial. And so I asked, you know, what did you experience? And it ran the lot, the gamut. And this was men. And it was similar to women's. And so then what I wanted to do was I lined up a number of men. It took a long time to get men to talk. And they spoke in a very particular way. And like some of my interviews lasted 3 hours and I was exhausted because the men were fumbling over what it was that they were trying to say to bring it in a certain, to get an understanding of it. So I contacted a couple of researchers in England who were being called clean language. So instead of interviewing people top down, a language that I believe was developed to help us understand women's experience, it wasn't working for men because men said, no, that's not, you know, that's not right. That's not right. So I began to look at the language that they used. So there's a thing called clean language, which is you only use the language that the people spoke about. If they don't have a language, you try and develop a metaphorical landscape for them. So we can say something like, you know, she was like a demon. Okay, demon is like what? Or tell me about the demon. What is it about the demon? So they would talk in metaphor. They used pretty much the same metaphors men do. They use religious ones, demon, spirit, those kinds of things. They use sporting metaphors. They use disaster metaphors. They use war metaphors. And did I say sporting? They are just the four that stuck out. So as this thing progressed, I was able to bring a three-hour interview down to 20 minutes to begin to understand what it was. And the men were comfortable because they were speaking in a language that they understood. And they used these different metaphors. And all of them were pretty much the same. And there was a bit of backlash because I also believe that we need to understand the strategies that people use to defend themselves. If you're a victim of domestic violence, you may have done certain things as well. I got beaten up over that. verbally by a number of people who said I was victim blaming, and I said that's not my, you know, I'm not trying to victim blame, but I'm trying to understand what strategies do people use so that we can understand those things as well in case they're used against them, or it gives us a bigger understanding. So I've been doing that for years and years. It's on hold at the moment because I nearly lost my mind doing it. It's not I lost my mind, but it's when you sit in that level of, and again, dysfunction, this is beyond anything I have, sitting with people there and they're telling you the most intimate things when it goes on, and understand this a bit more. Is this where I want to go? So it took me like to the furthest reaches of the universe and back. And so I have a good understanding of it, and I am going to go back to it. It's, I know I've been told that, you know, you don't have to put this amount of work into it because all you want is your card to the club, which I want. I want to sit properly and do it properly. And if there is, and it's to remove the voyeuristic thing about it, but to have a proper understanding. And if we are to talk to men about this, we need to talk a particular way, and you will get the answer you need. That's the short answer to that.
Wonderful. No, it's great.
There's lots of men. There's lots of men out there who, you know, I think it's 1 in 4, they say, women, but only 1 in 20 men report it. Murray Strauss, who, again, one of the leading researchers in this, in the 70s and 80s, before he died, he published a paper that said, we lied. we hid the numbers because we wouldn't have gotten funding. But he reckons that the numbers are pretty much similar. Now, when you take away the violent part, physical stuff, but there is quite a bit of it there as well. And if you go to any emergency department in the world, and especially in the Western world, you'll find a lot of men who have come in who have been physically assaulted by their wives or partners. So there's a lot of hidden stuff. I know I pipe up on stuff every now and again, and I just get battered by people who you know, don't have an understanding of it, or have bought into the idea that it's men always as the perpetrators. But, and again, sorry, just to get this out, is that everybody should be supported. There's a huge, I'm going to leave it at that because I'm not getting political, but there is a huge issue. We have seen a massive rise in it now. I know a lot of women have come forward, but I know a lot of men come forward as well. If you talk to, they're not amen, they've changed to Men's Aid. The numbers there have risen massively as well. But we need poor men who come forward and not just write them off and say, oh, you know, you're weak, or, you know, but we need to support everybody, not just the women. Sorry.
Yep. That's great. No, thanks for elaborating on that. It's something I'm really curious about, and I know a little bit, but not enough. Now, tell me about this Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and you have a couple of options there. Either the Kermit the Frog or Judy Garland.
I love the two of those, Judy Garland. I got both. The reason, I guess, like Kermit the Frog, for me, is on a par with Freud. Actually, he's probably more important than Freud. As a kid, I heard Kermit the Frog sing, you know, if just one person believed me, which is amazing. And that's what I carry through in my work. But the rainbow connection as well. Like, if you can say to a child, you're awesome. If no child has ever heard that, like, it's amazing. You know, can you imagine being a child in a situation where you've been beaten or kicked or living in poverty or living in the back of a car with your mom and nobody's ever said anything nice to you and somebody believes you? It's amazing. And I got that from Kermit the Frog. And I remember as a kid looking at him. I know it's, but even as an adult, I can feel it now. He would talk to people, and it was like, you knew, you know, as Jim Henson, I am under no illusion that Kermit is real, but to me, he was. He had the most beautiful way of talking to kids. I think the rainbow connection was the same. You know, the bigger world we live in, racism is a horrible thing, xenophobia is a horrible thing, you know, and that. But Somewhere Over the Rainbow, to me, is the greatest song ever written. It has everything in it. Brilliant. And I don't think anybody's ever got that.
somewhere over the rainbow, way up high. There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Well, let's talk about music there for finally, because amongst all these things you've been doing, you found time to put together a really cool album, and you know, Tales from the Tenderloin, and it is really good. And I played a couple of your songs on the other show, and I will keep playing it because it's just great. And but tell me about music. Like you put a tweet there the other day that you have 40,000 hits on 40,000 streams, I should say, on Spotify, and you got Squish FA out of it, and it's just not right, okay, that you artists are getting nothing out of this. But obviously music is very important. You use music when you're working with kids. You've done that in the past using music. So, but tell me about this album and what's happening now that you've had it out a few years. When you first released the single, you gave all the money that you raised, you gave it to Simon Community, if I remember correctly. So tell me, what is music and what's this album doing for you? And tell me a bit about it.
So music for me, growing up in the 70s, the radio, it was everything. I devoured magazines. It was a means of expression. And so because it worked for me, I think it can work for everybody. So I teach kids the ukulele. I teach adults the guitar. It saved so many of us. You can talk to any musician and they'll go, oh, my God, a guitar saved me, or a trumpet saved me. And so it's the, for me, I guess, because I was limited in English, I think I failed English in my Leaving Cert, so I couldn't write about it. And enough people had written really good songs about, or books about, urban areas. Tom Waits does it, You Can't Beat Tom Waits. Lou Reed has done it, You Can't Beat Him. But this one night, so I landed in the Tenderloin. There was a barman there, two barmen. One was Drew Harrison, an awesome musician as well. And this guy we used to call King George, who was the barman there. And George was about 5'3", 5'4", sounded like Al Pacino. We never believed anything he told us. Oh, I was a Marine, and one time off the coast of Madagascar, or, I was an iron worker. We didn't believe a word George told us. But he was mean and he was ornery, but he minded us, he out for us. He understood, we were the old country, and somewhere back in his history, he had Irish blood. This one night, we closed up the bar and we went to a local eatery that was 24 hours. We stayed for a couple of hours. The whole thing began with George, and he had no filter. He walked in, we sat down, and next thing his nose in the air and he's sniffing. And he turned around to the ladies, who I think were worlds behind us. And he said, ladies, he says, I smell a cheap perfume. You're either a waitress or a hooker. And I thought I was going to die. But he had this charm. He was one of those rogues that no matter what he said to you, you wouldn't take offense. So we stayed there for 2 hours and I listened to this conversation and we left. 2 hours after that, chef shot the whip. Now, we're not blaming George. They'd worked together for 30-odd years. She would often send things into the back that weren't on the menu. He would peed off and go out and give out to her and they'd argue. But this one morning, 6:30 in the morning, she came on for her shift. Somebody ordered something that wasn't on you. She walked into the back. He walked out after her, and he shot her. So that was this. That's how this whole thing began, is that it started with this conversation in the Pinecrest. And as George and I, we were drunk. We walked through the line. We met to people who sparked amazing things in me. You know, I met a homeless person sitting in a shop cart, said that they had worked on Mrs. Doubtfire from Williams. And it was, hey, can you imagine what it's like if Mrs. Doubtfire wakes up and Robin Williams is dead? And it stuck with me, being a huge Williams fan. And so that's in there. And the morning after he died, I was in bits. And I just sat in my window at work, and a robin landed on my window. This is as true as I'm sitting here. And the song just came out. It's a minute and a half. I didn't want to be sad because it wasn't fair. You know, I think he'd given enough. There were young people who were broken, who had run away from the Midwest to San Francisco. Lives became even worse. And that's the thing for me, I guess this whole album is about people. It's about humanity and it's good in its bad form. You know, there's old couples there who would argue about whatever, but their dream was if one of them died, the other one would meet them at the gates of heaven. Veterans, a lot of veterans homeless in America who will tell you their stories. They won't go into the nitty gritty because, you know, that's not something you want to bring up to somebody. But what I did find out, there was an old guy, Gordon, a beautiful old guy. He was in his 70s and he couldn't read or write in the 40s when he enlisted. And they wouldn't let him join because they said you wouldn't be able to write home or read letters from home. But before mobile phones and social media, the importance of letters, you know, letters were important because, you know, even just me or you or I, when we were kids, writing to somebody in America or writing here. But for somebody who had stepped up to serve their country, were in a foreign country, kids, 18, for them to write home, I guess, put their best foot forward and say, you know, I'm doing good, we're winning. But on the inside, they were like, you can't imagine, like kids in Vietnam, kids in Korea. They were 18 and they were sent off somewhere to kill people because their government had said, this is the right thing to do. But they did it. And you would hope for their sake that it was done in good faith or that it was to the betterment of the world. But the importance of these letters was something that I heard from a lot of people. So the battle is in there and it's three different letters. The first parts of the letters would be, you know, I'm doing good, I'm standing up strong. But then the horror that they were facing, that I think was important to talk about as well. But I met veterans who had given their lives for their country. When they came back, they were told to get off a bus in San Diego. The majority of them had post-traumatic stress. They had seen things that we can't imagine. And they were expected to go on like that. So these men, mostly men, you know, they were just cast aside. So I thought it was important for me because I'd met so many of them. And like the last song on the album, and again, it's nighttime in any big city is very different, and especially amongst the homeless people. As the sun comes up, they're kind of chased away or, you know, they're pushed back. So the last song maybe is the one that, you know, maybe things will be better. But in my own head, as this would rise up, homeless people who were cast singing. And that was just the way it ended. But it was a great experience. And all of those people, everybody should have a voice, I think. And especially those who are broken and are lost or alone.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely album, and so obviously you're not putting it out on Spotify. What's it, Bandcamp? Are you doing Bandcamp now? Is that what people can
get? I put it out on Spotify. I didn't know how any of these things work, and I'm just glad I have a day job. so I put it out on Spotify because somebody, I was told I had to, and I went, okay. But then, you know, you make money. I went, well, hey. So last week, there was 40 plus thousand streams, and I think I got like €30.
How much? Sorry, you just broke up. How much did you get?
30 euros.
Yeah, lovely. That should get you. Should get your meal when the restaurants reopen. right.
But you see, you know, all the people listening to and I see them all now on Twitter and Instagram and that. And you know, their livelihoods have been taken away. And I know we've signed up for Spotify and those things, but luckily you have Bandcamp, and I've been building a Bandcamp site on there as well, right, which will get the money to the artists. And it, right, it just reminds me of like the 80s and 90s in America when you had those punk labels who put out these fantastic, you know, Fugazi and Bad, yeah, Brains and all those. It's a movement. And so it came from people who said, hell with this. If only we can get kids to do it. Kids now, I guess, are not the same as in the 80s, 90s. They are there, and we have to find them. Yeah. People like yourself, people like Late Date and RT, there's lots of really good producers. People in Dublin FM, there's lots and lots of people there who are pushing and pushing. I guess they're all musicians as well, and saying this is the way to do it. So it's this great movement has started. So I'm just following along because I, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm an imposter because I don't do this full time, but I like it. And, you know,
now what you produce is very good.
Is the way to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll put all the links on the show notes anyways for people to get you. So before we finish off, tell me about the World According to Garp as your favorite book, or one of the books you picked.
It's the first book I ever read from cover to cover. And again, it was the 80s. I think a friend of mine, Gordon Laffin, had said, look, there's this great book. And I read it, and it took me a while to read it because I didn't like reading. But it was the beauty and the richness of these characters. And then the film came out, and Robin Williams was in the film. And I was like, oh, my God. And maybe identified, you know, he was a young man raised by a single mom. And then you had these different characters that they came across. Feminists, transvestites, drug addicts, writers. But it showed the possibility, I guess, of everything. And though I never met Robin Williams, I did sit outside his house for an hour once with my buddy. He lived in San Francisco. And lots of, you know, the homeless people I knew had met him. His nanny actually was from around here as well. So I used to hang out with her and go for meals. Now, I never let on that I knew, but I was busting to get into that house. I love John Irving.
He's good.
I just love the way he writes characters. And again, he kind of looks at the underdog. Maybe that's why I'm attracted to it. You know, and I love that phrase from the Cider House Rules, you know, you kings of New England, you princes of Maine. Love it. Love it.
Very good. Well, listen, Wayne, we could talk all night, but we won't, because we both have a lot of stuff to do. But I want to know, what about, is any new music coming out? Anything you've written that is going to be produced shortly?
Yeah, well, I've written a whole album, and again, I'm going to try and make it different, but the first one was going to be an album, Personality Disorders. So if Personality Disorders could sing, what would they say? So I have written a narcissistic personality disorder love song. It's called Muse. So it's just to get somebody to sing that with me now as well. So it's going to be this call and response from a narcissist, and people fall in love with narcissists. The rest of it is just I have another one that's actually wrote it 20 odd years ago, but I want to change it. And it's a two-way conversation between a mother and her unborn child. As you know, I'm not a man, but I imagine, because I've listened to enough people talk to their bellies. And then kind of songs about small town Ireland. So yeah, most of them are written, and I'm just looking into do maybe some co-writes with people. But I want to do an album of duets as well, whatever they be. I'm never going to write a pop song. I don't think I'm not able. I don't know. So it's just indulge my own. And you know, if I like it, there must be somebody else out there too who will listen to it. And it's different. And, you know, it's, and again, it's just And that's the nice thing about music. It makes all things possible. We can write about anything. And there will be people there who, oh gosh, that's, you know, that reminds me. So there's a whole album written. I'm going to start recording in January.
Wonderful. And tell me something, if we were to leave this conversation with one of your song, what would you pick? Pick your favorite child.
Oh, my favorite child. I'll tell you right now, I have a son with autism, and I got my whole record on this album. And he doesn't speak, but I got him to laugh. So if there was one, because of him, I guess, like, he's the first non-verbal autistic person to be on an album and to be heard. So with that, it would be maybe the last song on there. Now, I know it sounds, but it sounds as I wanted it to sound, because it, for me, it's all of those people who were pushed aside or made to feel terrible. And the song reflects that. We didn't overproduce it. We put mistakes and things into it. And that's the one, I guess, called Maybe. Because it's kind of has all the people who were mentioned in the album in it. And my kids, my wife were on there. And my son, who is nonverbal. And you hear him laughing.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm going to be listening to your music in a completely different way now, in a much more profound way. So it's great. Listen, keep doing what you're doing with this. It's absolutely brilliant. And I'm sure our path will cross somewhere, somehow, hopefully in real life. Next time I'm down in Middleton, I'll give you a shout and I can buy you a coffee. I will indeed. Yeah, I'd normally pass by, but at the moment I can't go anywhere like the rest of us.
So. Yeah. thank you so much for everything that you do. I mean, you're doing this for the love of it. And it's awesome. And it, like, you know, you're going to reach corners of the world or universe that you never thought you're going to get to. But thank you so much for doing this. You don't know how much it means.
My absolute pleasure.
Maybe if I kill myself, you can talk to me. Maybe if I were a cat, you'd rescue me down from a tree. Maybe if I were a goldfish, you'd change my water every day. Maybe I'll be a car and you can drive me away. Maybe I'll be that letter that you write every night. Maybe I'll be an aeroplane, you take me out on every flight. Maybe I'll be that baby you hold tightly in your arms. Maybe I'll be an actor. Who wins you with this charm? Maybe I'll be a TV and you'd watch me every hour. Maybe I'll be a rainstorm and my tears will be devoured. Maybe I'll be your mother, your father, your lover. Maybe I'll be your friend. Street corner Messiah preaches to his people, and the message that he brings is love. Maybe you'll hear his words of wisdom. Just maybe. Yeah, just maybe. Maybe I'll be a picture and you'd hang me on your wall. Maybe I'll be a trampoline, you can bounce back when you fall. Maybe I'll be a hound dog and answer to your call. Maybe I'll be what I want to be most of all. Maybe I'd be a window and you'd see right through me. Maybe I'll be a bird in a cage, you can come set me free. Maybe I'll be a river, you can come swimming.